The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see? Pick up the mirror now, America. Go ahead, pick it up. What are you, afraid? It's just a mirror, America. What could it do to you except reflect your image? The Majority Report.
It is Monday, November 22nd, 2010. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report, broadcasting from the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in central Manhattan, New York. Let me tell you something, folks. The fact that we are broadcasting, netcasting, podcasting, whatever you want to call it, this show, moments from 11:30 a.m. On this day is astonishing. The Cedar juggernaut rolls on despite the fact an intense amount of problems over the weekend. Where to start? I should tell you, we have a great show today. Jacob Hacker will be on. He is the author of a new book. I guess it's not that new. It's new, more or less, to me, but it's about a couple months old, entitled The Winner Take All Politics. It's a fascinating book that really talks about why we have such income disparity in this country, and how the rich have managed, the uber rich have managed to get so rich. But before we get there, a couple of stories. First off, I want to just note the passing of Chalmers Johnson, the author of Blowback, The Sorrows of Empire. He was a somewhat frequent guest on the first Majority Report. And we will, later today, I think, probably post two interviews that we did with him back on the first Majority Report. One, I think, Jeannie and I, and then the other is guest hosted by David Cross. And he passed away, I believe it was yesterday or sometime over the weekend, and a really important voice on the just the sort of ridiculousness of the size of our empire, more or less, in terms of the dollars spent on our so-called defense, as it were. So we will post that later today if we can get to it. Maybe tomorrow. We are having some problems here today, folks. I don't know if I should start on the small end or the big end, but Evan is sitting there. His arm is wrapped in gauze. Evan, why don't you tell us why your arm is wrapped in gauze?
It's superficial, really. I had a little motor vehicle mishap this weekend, last night.
What happened? Did you give yourself did you cut yourself on the radio? What, I mean, why do you have gauze? What does that mean? Were you trying to change the oil and you did not?
No, it was raining in Jersey last night for like 5 seconds, which is, you know, awful timing on my part. And just spun out in my car on the way back to New York and hit the guardrail, and that's an airbag flash burn.
Oy.
But I'm okay.
Unbelievable, folks. I get an email from him at 5:30 in the morning. I'm just going to bed now. Been in a car accident. Don't worry, I'll be there. It's astonishing that we've got this show up. You're going to get one of these, buddy. And this is in a good way, not a... That's not a facetious shofar blow. That is a celebratory props to you, sir.
I'm honored, Sam. Thank you.
I think at the moment your car was spinning out, my tooth broke in half. That's why if I'm talking strangely, it's because I have half a tooth in my molar. It's unbelievable. I had like a root canal, and like I'm eating popcorn last night, half the tooth falls off. And fortunately, I saved it. It doesn't look good. I'm getting old. My teeth are falling apart. And we get in this morning. Oh, if you're wondering why there's no Sammy Cam today, because we have, and thank gosh, we got that new computer. That was, when we bought that new computer last week, I guess in time for the launch, right? Or the next day.
Yeah, the next day.
It was a huge decision because we're on a very, 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 very tight budget here. And but we sprang for the new computer, and it's a good thing because the old computer, we can't get it online. Sometimes it decides to go online, sometimes it doesn't. There doesn't seem to be any type of rhyme or reason for it.
I'll just keep hitting it in the background here. It might come on at some point.
Right. If you keep banging it, maybe that'll help. And then on top of that, I sent out an email last night, and I forgot to change the subject line from the last week's email. So there are people showing up today thinking the majority report is launching today.
Yes.
Dorsey, in charge of our social media and marketing, you think that's a good idea. Someone sent me an email saying, like, Sam, you know, I'm not going to let you get away with this launching the show today meme for too long. I also noticed my back is killing me, so we've got to change the microphone situation. There's all sorts of problems. We're still going to provide with you a show. I'm going to stop bitching about it shortly. And just remind you that there are two things keeping the show afloat right now. One of them is just coffee, which I consume in copious amounts.
Very, very good.
My wife was very, very pleased with the – I don't know what the – I don't know what kind it was. I got to ask her again, but it was the coffee aromatic, the chocolatey aromatic one. She made a point of telling me today. She was very happy with it. She apparently was listening the other day when I referenced the fact that there's very few things these days that I get any positive feedback on. And the coffee has been it. And hopefully she can't access the show right now. So if you head over to justcoffee.coop, you use the coupon code MAJORITY, you'll save 10%, and you'll help the show. And if you don't drink coffee, or you do drink coffee and want to help the show more, your subscriptions make this show possible, period. Period. Eventually down the road, hopefully we'll have YouTube revenues and we'll have ad revenues and corporate underwriting from major agricultural firms like ADM, and we'll have Mobil Exxon will be sponsoring us to put out stories that are critical of scientists who speak of global warming.
Here's hoping.
Exactly. I mean, if we're fortunate, we'll have a major we'll have places like GE, people who have billions of dollars invested in us maintaining a permanent war machine. You know, I was on MSNBC this morning, and there was a couple of interesting topics. You know, I do those shows because it promotes this one, frankly. And there was a very touching story about a U.S. military soldier who Engel, the reporter, the NBC embedded reporter in Afghanistan, was with during a firefight, and they became close, and he followed up on this guy's return home. And it was a really touching story, and he spoke, the sergeant spoke of losing his friends in battle. And it was really, I mean, I sat there, and it was a very emotional story about sort of the price of war. And it was almost as if, you know, it really struck me. The next story to follow up was on North Korea's centrifuges to enrich uranium. And, you know, I remember feeling coming out of that story like, wow, how do you move to the next step here? And the next step is, okay, anybody who's having any questions as to, you know, the idea of us sending our a 23-year-old guy who's never had a glass of champagne into two tours in Afghanistan, We're going to follow that up with, but Kim Jong-il may end up blowing us all up. And it really, it was something I wanted to ask the producer about. He would have looked at me like I was from a different planet. Like, how do you decide to juxtapose those two stories? Maybe, and I really do think that even if it's not, there's nothing nefarious there, you know, psychologically the idea is war has expenses that we, and costs that we never really contemplate in terms of what it does to our fellow Americans. Never mind what it does to innocent civilians living in Afghanistan or Iraq for that matter. But if you are starting to feel in any way that maybe the costs are too high, let's just remind you that we could get blown up at any time by the Koreans. And then we can move track from there into, like, you know, Sarah Palin on whatever, you know, America Sings, whatever the hell the name, Dancing America, whatever the hell the name. What is the name of that show? Dances with Stars. I'm sorry. It's embarrassing. I can't even get the name of it right to criticize it. So, yes, I was on Jansing & Company today. The most interesting thing that came out of it was, for me, was it pointed me to a story about Mitt Romney. And, you know, we're going to hear more and more stories about this. And I'm in a little bit of a cynical mood today, I have to tell you. And I think part of that is just the reading excerpts of this Jacob Hacker book he co-authored with Paul Pearson. And reading and just thinking about the implications of this, that essentially our government is not run, but is so heavily influenced by the rich in this country that it's hard to see how we're going to reverse this trend. And it's increasing, of course, with the Supreme Court basically saying that corporations are people, they can give as much money as they want. Campaign finance is just being completely chipped away. This story about Mitt Romney, and again, Mitt Romney is going to have to account to his lunatic fringe base, his comments and his essentially signing that Massachusetts health care reform law, his comments that I mentioned the other day that ended up in an amicus brief in Florida, where Republicans are trying to sue, I guess, or in Florida to keep the Health Care Reform Act from being instituted in Florida, where Romney had basically said upon signing the Massachusetts law, my libertarian friends have to get used to this mandate, because better that citizens pay for it than the government pays for it. Be that as it may, Romney, apparently, according to the New York Times, has figured out a way in which what they refer to as allows him to tiptoe around federal campaign finance limits. You know, I mean, why do we have federal campaign finance laws? It's because we want a specific outcome, to limit the amount of money that corporations, and I guess if you're a right winger, that unions can give to campaigns. And so when you tiptoe around it, it really, it's not so much tiptoeing. It's circumventing, it's laundering money is really what it is. It's legal laundering of money. He apparently has set up, and this may be common practice, but it's picking up momentum, it appears. He set up state PACs, or leadership, or state versions of his leadership PAC. And he has a committee in Alabama, which apparently has the most some of the most permissive campaign finance rules in the nation, allows contributions of a limited size from individuals and corporations. He's getting hundreds of thousands of dollars, usually in big $50,000, $100,000 donations. So his Alabama affiliate of his federal PAC, Free and Strong America. I got to get some soundtrack for that. Like,
only God, no other king. Let the mighty eagles soar.
Yeah, that's Ashcraft. Free and Strong America. And it's raised more than $450,000 this year. This is just in Alabama. Contributions amounting to tens of thousands of dollars each. It's only donated $21,000, less than 5% to state and local candidates in Alabama, which it was set up to do. And then it basically filters the money in to pay for people who are gearing up for his presidential campaign but are ostensibly working on his PAC. And they're working the system where, like, if you've got Joe Blow working for his PAC, they're getting 50% of their money from a federal PAC. And then they're getting proportionate amounts of their salary from the different state PACs. So if they have 10 state PACs, you know, they're getting 10% from each of the state. It's really just unbelievable. It really is unbelievable. And I don't know, in the wake of Citizens United, how we're going to be able to stop any of this. You know, there was some talk that because Kirk from Illinois, the Republican who won in Illinois, the senator, because he was for the Disclosure Act, allowing for more disclosure of these things, that somehow the effort might be renewed in the Senate. I don't think so, folks. I don't think anything's going to happen in this lame duck session. I think we'll have a vote on the DREAM Act, possibly. If we're lucky, we'll have a vote on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I don't know if these things will get passed. Seems to me there'll be a political price to pay for the Republicans, but great. So there'll be, you know, I'll tell you this. I know what will be passed. I know what will be passed. I mean, you can stop anything from being voted upon in the Senate. You can muck up the processes in the House. But I guarantee you there will be one thing that is passed. At least one thing. And I don't know in what shape or form it will take, but tax cuts for the wealthy will be passed. There is no doubt in my mind. And it's depressing as all hell. And it'll be an extension just long enough for the Republicans to take control of the Senate in 2012, and then they'll be made permanent. Let's take a 30-second break. We'll be right back. We're back. Coming up in about 10 minutes, we'll have Jacob Hacker. Apparently, have you seen this story? The Pope has come out in a book and in furtherance of his, and I guess the, well, I mean, when he says it, right, that's Catholic dogma. When the Pope says it, that's what the Catholic Church, I guess there's some other committee of bishops. I don't know exactly how it works. I do know that in a new book, it says condoms, of course, are not justified between a couple, because that would be contraception, and you're preventing, the only thing you're supposed to use your genitalia for, apparently, is to procreate. However, there are instances where he says that condoms might be allowed to be used, is apparently male prostitutes, because it would be helpful in the stop of the spread of AIDS. And presumably when he says male prostitutes, because he said the contraception is not an issue, he's only talking about male-on-male prostitutes. So if you are a male prostitute who services women, you're being a bad Catholic if you use a condom, I guess. Is that the lesson that we're supposed to take from this? I have to say that on some level, at least there is some consistency here. And I believe that the Vatican has come out and clarified the comments that he's not promoting or condoning male prostitution. And I guess, I mean, but at least there's some consistency, right?
Yeah, that's pretty consistent.
And I guess presumably he's not condoning female prostitution either. But if you're a female prostitute, you cannot use a condom because you could be procreating if you're involved with a man. If you're a female prostitute who services women, you don't need a condom. So I wonder, like, how do you deal with this if you teach catechism? How do you deal with this if you teach Catholic school? Aren't you supposed to, when the Pope gives an edict, or you supposed to translate? Do you know?
I was a bad Catholic growing up.
Dorsey? You have no idea. All right. I was just curious. This is an interesting story. You'll recall several years ago, there were two APAC officials, Steve Rosen and Keith Weissman, who were charged in 2004 with espionage for allegedly pressuring a Washington Post reporter into running classified U.S. government information they had obtained about Iran. Now, APAC, for those of you who don't know, is the right-wing pro-Israel lobby. And they're right-wing not because they're pro-Israel. You have J Street, which is a pro-Israel but left-wing pro-peace pro-Israel lobby. APAC is a right-wing, neoconservative, Likudnik lobby, which has consistently pushed America to push Israel to be far more belligerent in that country. It caused all sorts of problems when it came to that invasion of Lebanon, ostensibly to fight Hezbollah. And there were two members who were charged with espionage in 2004. The charges were dropped last year, supposedly due to lack of evidence. I have no reason to believe otherwise, although that's, who knows. And apparently one of the guys, Steve Rosen, who was fired by APAC at that time, is suing for either defamation or some type of unjust firing. And what's coming out in his in Discovery is pretty bad for APAC. Now, there's the tawdry stuff about apparently everyone in the APAC offices regularly consumes porn in the office. So, now, I have nothing against pornography, and, you know, half the time I look over, I can't tell what Dorsey's doing. And as long as you do it in the I mean, as long as you do it in a way that does not in any way interfere with what's going on at work, Dorsey, I have no problem with that. But that's the part that's going to get all the story, right, is the porn, and I guess there was some prostitution or I'm not sure what. It doesn't matter. The pornography, great. At least they're human there. The real problem is that the Washington Post reports that Rosen says his actions were common practice at the organization. You know, AIPAC fired him, and their defense is that we fired him for his conduct in terms of getting involved in this. It may not have reached the level of criminality, ultimately, but he should not be trading in this type of top-secret information. But Rosen says his actions are common practice. He said that the next move, his next move is to show that AIPAC regularly traffics in sensitive U.S. government information, particularly dealing with the Middle East, which makes most sense. He says, by email to the Washington Post, I will introduce documentary evidence that AIPAC approved of the receipt of classified information. Most instances of actual receipt are hard to document because orally received information rarely comes with classified stamps on it, nor records alerts that the information is classified. But they condone this. The leadership of AIPAC condone this. And M.J. Rosenberg reports at Al Jazeera that Rosen has 180 documents that could prove that Howard Kaur, AIPAC's executive director, and probably the AIPAC board as well, knew exactly what Rosen was doing. This is good news because AIPAC is an organization that is not only helping create peace in the Middle East, they're hindering that. Not only are they promoting the continuance of settlements on land that on the West Bank that is not Israel land, that is occupied territories. But in my estimation, as someone who is generally pro-Israel, certainly pro-Israel, pro the concept of Israel, and has an emotional attachment to that country, I think they're doing more to damage the future prospects and viability of Israel as a democratic state in the future than any other American organization that exists now. I think at times they were actually even worse than the Bush administration because they were pushing the Bush administration to push Israel in ways that were not healthy for Israel. Israel always has depended on the American administrations providing a check against what they feel they need to do to address domestic concerns. And America did not play that role when it meant invading Lebanon and in their latest incursion into Lebanon and attacking Hezbollah, and it came back and blew up in Israel's face. So we need a strong buffer with the U.S. administration against Israel's more aggressive tendencies. And a PAC like AIPAC hurts that effort. And so anything that hurts AIPAC, in my mind, is a positive thing. You know, people should go and respond to this AIPAC story by contributing to J Street. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back with our guest, Jacob Hacker. We are back. This is the Majority Report. On the phone, Professor Jacob Hacker of Yale. He is the author, co-author, I should say, of Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. He authored this book with Paul Pearson of Berkeley. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks very much for having me on, Sam.
The book is, and I have to start right up front by telling you that I've only been able to read excerpts at this point, but from what I've been reading about the book and what I've read of the book, it really does seem, and I'm not the first person to say this, this is an incredibly timely book, and it could very well be one of the most important books about politics in years. And I say that coming from the perspective of someone who is somewhat disillusioned with what we've seen from the past 2 years of Democratic control in terms of addressing issues like income inequality and issues like financial regulation and taxation policy. And so just lay out for us the central thesis of your book.
Well, thanks for the kind words, Sam. I hope that you continue to think it's a great book when you've finished reading it. And it really turns out to be a pretty timely book, and perhaps more timely than we knew when we were writing it. When I say we, I mean my co-author Paul Pearson and I, because this last election and the amount of money that was thrown into it certainly reinforced our sense that there's a real challenge to a vibrant participatory middle-class democracy, and one that we think really needs to be addressed. And yeah, I mean, the basic argument of the book is that we've seen a generation in which most of the economic gains have gone to those at the top of the economic ladder. Fully 40% of all the household income gains between 1979 and 2007 accrued to the richest 1% of Americans. And we've seen that it's not just the richest 1%, but the richest 1/10 of 1%, 1/100 of 1% that have really shot into the economic stratosphere, while middle-class Americans have had to deal with the great financial crisis of the last few years, as well as slow or no growth in their incomes. And that's, to us, pretty puzzling, because this is, after all, a democratic society and system that's supposed to be highly responsive to the middle class. So our book is really a kind of a mystery story of how this happened and what it means for all of us and how we might turn it around.
Now, I just want to reiterate one point that you mentioned there, is that this isn't just simply about income disparity. It's about the incredibly intense concentration of wealth in a very small group of people's hands.
Yeah, I mean, it's really about two sides of that picture. One is the concentration at the top, and that's why we call the book Winner Take All Politics. It really is striking how concentrated the gains are among this very small circle of winners. One way to get a look at this is to take a look at the income tax statistics that that two economists, Emmanuel Saez and Thomas Piketty, have put together. And what they show is that in the 1970s, about $1 in $10 was earned by the richest 1% of Americans, and by the 2007, just before the financial crisis, we were talking about $1 in $4 being earned by this richest 1%. But what's even more striking is that it's really the small slices of that top 1% that have really reaped the lion's share of the gains. Say the top 1/10 of 1%, which had an average income of around $7 million. And so we really misunderstand what's happened if we focus just on kind of the broadening of the income ladder. What's really happened is the very top rungs have shot up into the clouds. And the other trend that I think it's really important to understand is this is not a victimless development. It's not as if it's just Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and Warren Buffett are getting richer and richer and the rest of us are just sort of getting to enjoy the trickle-down fruits. What we show is that over the same period that the very top pulled away, middle-class Americans saw their economic security decline, their income mobility stagnate, the college completion rate stagnate, debt levels skyrocket, and so on. And so we're talking about a really fundamentally negative story for most Americans alongside this story of super gains at the very top. And we're basically arguing that the link between these two really comes down to politics, not some kind of impersonal economic change, not technology, not globalization, but
right.
really what government did and didn't do.
That was what I was going to ask you, that there are people who will argue that this is the natural state of globalization or highly skilled and educated workers because of the nature of our new economy do better. But you quite clearly show that it's not a function of that.
Yeah, I mean, we have a number of ways that we try to knock that down. I mean, the first thing to note is that the suspect has a pretty good alibi. That is, if it's globalization and technological change, if it's computers and the internet, then presumably, you know, all the countries that experience globalization, technological change, and the like would experience this kind of top-heavy hyper-inequality. And the answer, when you start to look across the world, you find that among rich democracies, the United States really stands out. We're the country that's seen the biggest increase in inequality and the most top-heavy increase, the most concentrated increase at the top. I think the other side of our answer is, you know, we actually think there's not just strong circumstantial evidence, but sometimes really very direct evidence that public policy, what government did and didn't do, really played a big role in this. And I'll just give two quick examples. You mentioned financial deregulation. I think that's one that's really worth pointing out. It wasn't just that these titans of finance found out how to surf the new global currents. And it's also that they got very specific kind of advantages from public policy. Two economists looked at this and calculated that something like a third to half of the above-market earnings of Wall Street people, the degree to which they earned more than similarly educated and skilled people was due to deregulation and government policy. And we think it's probably even higher than that when you start to really delve into it. The other area is tax policy. You know, over the same period in which the rich have pulled away, government has slashed tax rates on the richest of the rich. Warren Buffett, you know, recently said, you know, it's ridiculous that I pay such a low tax rate on my income. You know, I might even be paying a higher tax rate, he said, than my secretary. And the sort of extreme example of this is hedge fund managers who earn sometimes hundreds of millions and even billions of dollars. Many of them pay a 15% capital gains tax rate on a good chunk of their income because of this loophole in the tax code that is deliberately preserved. Because it showers so much largesse on such an influential group of donors to the parties.
It was preserved, I think, in this past year, actually. I mean,
yeah,
specifically preserved.
Yeah, we're what, 4 years into the Democratic, 4 years after the Democratic capture of Congress in 2006. We're about to see the end of that era. Uh-huh. And over that whole period, Democrats just couldn't get their act together, apparently, to fix this egregious loophole in the tax code that everyone knows to be
well,
to be,
I mean, but that's the point. But that's the point, is that
right.
It's not. I mean, I think your book makes the argument that it's not a case of people getting their act together. That this is that this isn't a failure on the part necessarily of the Democrats to reverse this. This is baked into the cake. This is not
right.
necessarily a bug. This is it is a growing feature of both political parties, and that's the part that is so disturbing and frankly depressing to me.
I mean, we should be careful not to say both parties are the same. And,
no, I mean, I think
the Republican Party has definitely gotten pulled more toward the money and more toward the right by these developments. But you're absolutely right; it's affected both parties and. It is depressing in the sense that we think that votes should really be the thing that matters, and yet it's between elections when the lobbyists are running the show, and when this bipartisan pull toward the positions of the most organized, mobilized, and affluent members of society really shows itself.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the other primary argument of your book is that. It's one thing to win elections, but at the end of the day, it is institutions and organizations that impact the decision making of the politicians that really is more determinant of of I guess income disparity of income inequality, because they are the ones who are influencing the actual policies that will create, enhance, or diminish this disparity.
Yeah, I mean, one of the ways to think about this is that for voters, they have a pretty stark choice. They get to choose between parties and candidates that are put up to them by the parties and by organizations supporting them. And if both parties get pulled toward money, then that has a very fundamental effect on what the choice looks like. I mean, look at this last election. I think it's a great example. I mean, clearly Americans were really upset about the direction the government has been going, and they were overwhelmingly upset by their sense that it had gotten the government was really responsive to Wall Street and big business and not the middle class. You know, the surveys suggested that most Americans felt like government was really looking out for those at the top and not those in the middle. And so that came down to a question of, you know, what do we do? And so we throw the bums out and we throw out the party that's in power, even if the party that's not in power, the Republican Party, has been basically playing a double game, you know, simultaneously railing against bailouts and also, you know, cozying up to industry lobbyists and particularly Wall Street to try to make sure that Wall Street gives to them in this fall's election. And so the point is not that elections don't matter. They matter enormously. It's just that they're not the only thing that matters. And in particular, when you get beneath the kind of high-profile policy debates to the details of legislation, to how they get implemented, to what their effects are on the ground, to whether they get carried out at all, that's really when the lobbyists and the money matter. And, you know, that's where we're going to see the rubber meet the road on the financial industry regulations. It's where we're going to see the rubber meet the road on health care reform. And ironically, a lot of the compromises that had to be made to get these things through also made them even less attractive to most voters. So
right.
We really tell a story about how money and the rise of an organized business community transformed the Washington ecosystem, if you will, and with the result that both parties had to find, you know, a new niche. And the Republicans found the niche of the super conservative, business-friendly, anti-regulatory, you know, free market in name party. And the Democrats kind of cast about, and they basically threw, you know, they've got a kind of, you know, a pastiche of positions that represent, on the one hand, the fact that they're still the party of the little guy on a lot of issues. On the other hand, that they have to attract affluent, upper-middle-class folks who care more about environmentalism and some social issues than they do about these bread and butter economic issues. And then finally, they've got to get money, and the money really pulls them often towards the corporate position. So you have one party that on economic inequality is wearing a black hat. That's the Republican Party. There's no question about it. But it's not as if the Democrats are wearing white hats. They're kind of wearing gray hats. And, you know, every now and then the one or two of them, say Chuck Schumer on the hedge fund tax loophole, puts on the black hat because they have to defend their local economic interests.
Well, I mean, Jim Webb has come out recently and said that he was really shocked. One of the reasons why he became a Democrat as a lifelong, sort of, I guess, somewhat apolitical, I think, in his words, Republican, is that he saw the Democrats as standing up for the little guy, and he's been a little bit disillusioned. Now, let's go through the history of this, because it actually starts prior to the time, I think, when most people think that it would have started. It started during the late in the Carter administration, in terms of how, I mean, you talk about almost a feedback loop here as corporations gained more power, as they decided to organize, to push their agenda. They gained more power and more ability to push that agenda, and it starts in 1978, 79.
Yeah, it's the forgotten, you know, 2 years of American politics, 78 and 79. I guess that if we think about, you know, any turning point in recent American politics, we think about 1980 as the great year of the Reagan Revolution. Maybe we think about 1968 and, you know, the fact that you know, Nixon sort of paved a new kind of culturally conservative strategy that brought in the Southern voters disillusioned with civil rights and the war on poverty. But we never think about 1978. And in fact, as we show, 78 is this crucial year. And that has two reasons why we focus on this period. It not just this turns out to be the epicenter of the winner-take-all economy in many ways, the period in which the real sort of the tracks, the train switched tracks, but also because it's really revealing. This isn't a period in which we had a dramatic election. 1978 midterms were not ones that most people remember. Democrats had all two branches of government, in the sense they had both the House and both the Congress and the presidency. They had both houses of the Congress, and yet 78 saw the defeat of labor law reform, actually really dramatic defeat through a filibuster that was waged by Senator Orrin Hatch, Republican of Utah, who had just entered the Senate. You saw the defeat of a number of other progressive bills, including a consumer protection agency, including a minimum wage change, and you saw the defeat of, and this was probably the most consequential, you saw the defeat of Carter's more kind of progressive tax policies and their replacement with a series of big cuts on high-income taxes, including the first major cut in the capital gains tax that we saw in that period. So this really was a turning point, and since nothing happened on the sort of electoral front, the real story has to be understood as a reflection of what was going on in the business community. The business basically felt disadvantaged by the way in which politics had been going, and they organized on a broad scale. They were able to recruit candidates as well and really push new voices into Washington, and those voices were much more conservative. And that
Do you think Reagan's electoral success in 1980 was also a function of the same forces that made these changes in 78 and 79?
I do, and I think that there's no question that there was a very big change in the governing agenda. I mean, Reagan, of course, came to power riding a wave of discontent with the economy, but I don't think those economic troubles would naturally have translated into the very specific policy agenda that Reagan pushed. And as we point out, this is true again and again. It's not as if there aren't grievances felt among voters. For example, the property tax revolt of the late 1970s was centered around a really big issue about the way in which property taxes were hitting voters very hard in this inflationary environment of the late 1970s. So too were voters worried about so-called bracket creep, right, where they were moving into higher income tax brackets because of inflation. So these were real grievances, but they were harnessed to push a much larger agenda that had to do with deregulation of business, cutbacks in the union rights, the slashing of taxes very specifically on high-income taxpayers, which were not the taxpayers, it should be noted, who were angry about the property tax hikes or bracket creep. Those were mostly middle and working class taxpayers.
Well, we're seeing the same thing in some respects with the Tea Party, aren't we? I mean, is that a phenomena that may exist, but otherwise without the influence of literally tens of millions of maybe hundreds of millions of corporate dollars of corporate money increases its, I guess, its impact.
Yeah, I think that it's very hard to understand the fixation of Republican leaders on the high-end tax cuts, the extension of the high-end tax cuts, which are really only of benefit to the very richest Americans, you know, millionaires and above will receive very large tax cuts from extending all the Bush tax cuts, not just the middle class ones.
With data supporting the fact that they don't create jobs.
There's
no ancillary benefit.
There are very few small businesses that are going to be positively affected by extension of these upper income tax cuts. I mean, we had a big experiment in the 2000 period after the tax cuts in whether high-end tax cuts boost employment, and the answer was pretty unequivocally that no, that they do not. That there's no debate among economists that the tax cuts for the rich are the least efficient way of boosting jobs. The real reason why those have become the sort of guiding light of the Republican Party, it seems to me, is because of where the party gets its money and because of the long-term development of the party ideology in pursuit of and solidification of this business Republican alliance. So the point is that, you know, politics plays out through it plays out on this stage of electoral politics frequently. You know, every 2 years we have these big spectacular battles, but there are these long-term shifts in the structure of our politics and our parties, and we tell the story of how those long-term shifts have basically tilted the playing field away from the middle class, away from middle-class organizations, and in favor of those at the top and those political figures and parties that are most capable of benefiting from this new, you know, this new economic and political world.
I know we have to go shortly. I have two questions. One is, I think maybe my audience is not aware, but your health care reform proposal essentially became the proposal of all of the top three candidates, more or less, in the Democratic primary. And your proposals were in some ways the foundation for the health care reform that we got. One of the big elements of it, and maybe I'm overstating it from your perspective, was the public option. Now, I know you supported health care reform. Ultimately, you came to support it without the public option, and I know how much you fought to try and maintain it. But do you see the loss of the public option in the context of health care reform as another piece of this broader narrative of how corporate interests have impacted our policy making?
Oh, yes. I mean, I'm writing this book as I'm engaged in this grand healthcare fight, and it's I guess it was sort of a way of consoling myself because the forces I was up against were so big. But we were seeing, we meaning the people who were alongside me, struggling to try to preserve a robust public plan that would compete with private insurance, and you know, we're seeing today just how important that is as prices are skyrocketing upwards, and we see more and more consolidation of both the insurance and the provider sides of healthcare, you know, so that costs, I think, are really the big threat over the long term for this healthcare plan. You know, the conservative attacks are one thing, but if we can't control costs, then, you know, we really can't deliver on the promise of healthcare reform. So, yeah, I mean, when I was fighting on this, the degree to which it was just an uphill battle fighting really intense organized interests was you know, came home to me every day. And I would say that, you know, I think more generally that the Obama presidency, the great problem that it faced in its first 2 years was really that Obama came in promising transformative change, but to get things done, he and his aides basically decided that they had to try to work within the existing system, that they couldn't put reform of it on the front burner, but instead they really had to try to engage in what Paul Pearson and I call in the book, organized combat. So they brought in the sort of congressionalists, the people who had been working with Congress before, Rahm Emanuel chief among them, and they tried to kind of cut all the deals. They cut a deal with the hospital industry that may well have precluded the public option just from the outset. So they cut all these high-profile, high-stakes, high-cost deals to get the bill through. And what they ended up doing was creating a bill that didn't have a lot of enthusiasm. Now, was there another route? You know, that's the hard question. But I, you know, as I lived through it, I saw, you know, again and again that the world of winner-take-all politics was really constraining what the administration wanted to do and what I could do.
This is a subsidiary bonus question for me, so forgive me. But I mean, do you perceive it as the inability of the Obama administration to fulfill its promise of change is one of making a decision early on simply to be pragmatic, or do you think that in the final analysis, the perception of change is that the Obama administration, that Obama himself has, I mean, it's impossible to read someone's mind, is less than maybe the rest of us perceive, or the need for it, or the type of change?
Well, I think it's a combination of the two. And on policy issues, I think that there was a tendency for supporters of the president to assume that he was, you know, closer to them, supporters of the president on the left, to assume he was closer to them than he might have been. But I think that there is also a huge amount of pragmatic concessions that were made. And I think the biggest area of that, since I believe that the president sincerely came in thinking that Washington had to change, was basically saying, we're not going to push back against the way the system works. We're going to work within it rather than try to work, you know, to change it. And I think that cost the president very dearly. I think that if you look at the backlash against his presidency, it's fundamentally rooted in a sense that, you know, that Washington doesn't work, and it doesn't work in a very particular way, not the way that a lot of the conservative critics say, because they tend to focus on spending or the deficit alone, as if these are not, for most people, symptoms of deeper problems. The deeper problem is people think that Washington isn't responsive to the middle class. And I think by pursuing a kind of inside strategy and not really using the power of his rhetoric and his inspiration, the president fed into that critique. And so to me, that's the great question isn't whether the president couldn't have avoided midterm losses. There's no question that given where the economy was and was going to be, even with more aggressive measures to restore it, and given that it was a midterm election where presidents almost always lose seats, that he was going to face some losses. But the scale of that loss, I think, was avoidable and rested in substantial part on this decision to sort of focus on the inside game. You know, we can't rerun history, so I don't know if we're right, but I think...
Not to mention the damage that we've done in terms of a missed opportunity to espouse certain values and a framework for policies in the future.
And that's right, and this is a huge missed opportunity. I mean, I think the way to understand what's happened over the last few years is to say, look, we came in to this recession with already 15 or 20 years of severe neglect of basic economic problems facing the middle class, whether it was declining health insurance, whether it was growing gap between the middle and the top, whether it was the fact that we had seen some of the wellsprings of opportunity, like the opportunity to go to college or move up the income ladder, stagnate. All these areas, you know, were present even before the Great Recession. But then the Great Recession kind of made it undeniable that there were these deep problems within our society. But, you know, 2 years, 3 years out, we're facing a debate in which we could have deficit reduction and kind of cutting government dominate while the millions of Americans still remain out of work. And, you know, if there was any way to avoid that, then it's a great missed opportunity that it wasn't avoided.
Let me just one final. How do we combat this? I mean, if from an electoral standpoint, it's not enough to elect record-breaking majorities in the House and the Senate, or close to it anyways, and in Democratic control, how does the middle class, what do we need to do to influence this debate?
Well, it would be nice to think that there was some kind of easy answer, and there isn't. I think that we should divide this into a sort of medium and long term. In the medium term, I think that political reform is essential in making the case for political reform. I mean, remember that the one thing that I think seemed really striking over this last couple of years is that whenever the president and his staff believed that they couldn't achieve a goal, they decided to take it off the agenda. But fighting for things that are not achievable in the near term is often really good politics.
Yes.
And good policy.
Yes.
And so now that the president really has no prospect of achieving many of the things he believes in, I hope that he'll swing a little bit more for the bleachers. So making the case and having reform forces talking about these issues in a variety of forums is very crucial in the sort of immediate term. Over the longer term, I think it's going to take revival of what Paul Pearson and I and Winner Take All Politics call middle class democracy, and that's really a strong set of organizations that bring middle class Americans into politics. And I would say that the Tea Party actually offers a little bit of a reason for optimism here. I mean, here is a very networked, technologically savvy movement that has attracted a very intense but broad-based group of Americans to engage in politics. It's harder, of course, to engage those whose views are not as extreme. But I mean, one of the features of the last 15 years or so is the ability of to bring in more voices into politics, both through technology and through I think through a kind of more of an emphasis on accountability of politicians in office for what they do through these media, both the internet and through a rise of new organizational tools for those who are trying to build movements. And so it's just a difficult task. It's going to be a long slog, but it seems to me that we now know what the challenge is, and it's really to revive that kind of broad middle-class organization on new technological foundations.
Jacob Hacker, co-author of Winner Take All Politics with Paul Pearson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on, Sam.
We'll talk to you soon. Thank you again. All right, so that's it. It went a little bit longer, and but it's a fascinating book, and you'll be hearing more of it from me as we go on in the future. And, we'll have to do that that Ireland stuff for tomorrow.
Sure.
If we don't have some other horrible tragedy that befalls you. Folks, if you have the opportunity, if you are in a position where you can become a member of the Majority Report, simply go to majority.fm. You will see in the just below the banner the link to become, what does it say, become a member.
Become a member, yeah.
There you go. You can become a Majority Reporter for less than 50 cents a show over the course of a month. You can become a Cedarista or a professional leftist or a dirty effing hippie. Or you can become a French or a super Marxist. All members of the Majority Report, the Sam Cedar juggernaut. Or you can also become for $1,000 a month. You can actually become Sam Cedar. You can actually become me. You will host the show. You'll live with my family. You'll deal with the bills, the chores.
How's that going to work with the dental work?
You'll be getting your teeth replaced. You'll be sewing up Evan, replacing his radiator on his car, apparently. I'll come back. I guess I'll hang out in, like, I don't know, Mexico or something like that. I'm not sure exactly where. I haven't picked out a location. If we get enough Sam Cedars, I'll come back like a couple of weeks out of the year.
We're relocating the show there, right?
No, you guys will stay here. I'll be down there, and I will send, like, video postcards. All right, we're going to take a minute break. What?
One last thing. If you can't become a member, the ways that you can help out, watch our videos, repost our videos on Facebook.
Right.
Give us views, turn it on, turn off the volume in the background, let it play through.
If you go to samcedar.com, you will see our YouTube videos. And we're actually going to work on, I've been talking to Kyle, our web guru, about this. We have a couple of very interesting ideas on how you can help us promote the show. And I've got to tell you, the show has grown. We're all just sort of somewhat taken aback, both by the size, the pace in which people are listening, and the fact that it actually works. That we're actually able to deliver this product. Dorsey and I have had a lot of experience at Air America with not being able to deliver the product. Evan is what he's been able to do with pieces of gum and old, pieces of wire that I had in my basement has been amazing. And so we'd love to buy another computer. We can only do that if you become a member. And we will see you tomorrow. Tomorrow on the program, Ari Berman will talk about his book, Herding Donkeys. On Wednesday, Matt Taibbi. And I will, on Wednesday, in fact, we'll make this announcement now, email me at majorityreporters@gmail.com. If you've got a right-wing family member that you know you're going to have to deal with, and you've got a question on how to deal with that Thanksgiving dinner, email me. Dr. Cedar is in. I'm not a real doctor. At all. Not even a dentist. Not even a fake dentist. But I will help you deal with your right-wing family members. MajorityReporters@gmail.com. Folks, have a great day. And, we'll be right back with the IM session. Majority FM, just stick around for about 1 minute because I've got to go to the men's room. We are back. It is the post-show. We don't have the video today because our like some days we have this old G5, right? This old Mac G5 that I what's the word? When I made Pilot Season, that show, we bought the computer to edit it. And back then it was top of the line. And now it won't even do Gmail. Like, won't even do anything because it doesn't have an Intel processor. And, like, you know, depending on the day, and we haven't been able to figure this out, what days it is, but depending on the day, it will not get online. It just simply will not get online. And that is today is one of those days. So know that your memberships, you bought one computer, and insurance for the office rent, and hopefully we'll be able to pay Evan and Dorsey this month. We'll see. Particularly, Evan has screwed up his car. I've got to run into the dentist while I'm still on a dental plan. But apparently they don't cover this.
Then what is it for exactly?
No, just maintenance. But I was in there like 3 weeks ago, and I was like, you know, my tooth, it's hurting a little bit. And I think my jaw is like contracting and my teeth are expanding and it's breaking things. Okay, let's go to the IM. You can IM me at Majority FM on your IM thing, your IM service. And again, I want to apologize. I didn't say this. The email I meant to send out was supposed to have a different topic. Okay, AOL system message. This guy emails me constantly. You've signed in from another location. Okay. God, man. Come up with something a little more relevant for the show. I hear Palin's book is coming out, says Kenny Mack. Must this woman ruin every Thanksgiving? You know, I spoke to David Bender, late of Air America, last night. And he's convinced that Palin is running based upon where her book tour is. Her book tour is hitting all of these primary states. I hope she runs. Klug P, update. Let's see. You are in the majority. I feel I am like you, in the majority with regard to our military expenditures. Something has got to give. Update the Apple. Get Flash, get Shockwave Flash, get Java.
It won't go on the internet.
Yeah. Klug, it won't go on the internet. Avedon, all this is Thomas Aquinas' fault, you know. He made that stupid argument, you can't use your genitalia for anything but reproduction, like he never had to pee before. Avedon, back in the house! I got to get new sounds. Svengali says, oh my God, Svengali, you've got to start a blog. You've got to start a blog. He just did it on my IM. Seriously, there's like a... your guess is actually completely correct. Why do you say actually completely correct? There is no Ustream today, folks, because we can't get our computer online. We need to get a new computer, among other things. And dental work. Car repairs. Dorsey needs to update his stash. Your guess is actually completely correct. That's not the way you say that, Svengali. You say, your guess is completely correct. Or I completely agree. Don't act surprised. It's something I'm sure a lot of people would not like to hear. One measurement of economic equality is called the Gini coefficient. It's a formula which takes a graph and graphs the possession of wealth, vertical, versus the percentiles of the population, horizontal. As we approach the right, the income level rises and we go up. The income earned rises. If you were to draw a 45-degree angle from one end to another, you had you would have perfect income equality. Okay, so like this. So in other words, if we did this on the y and the x axis, that's perfect income inequality. I mean equality, correct? Wait, why am I showing this to the camera? The camera's not working. I'm drawing this and showing it. Tough day for us folks, believe me. Natural income will fall along a curve called the Lorenzo curve. Okay, look, dude. I need to have the computer. What we need to do is, okay. I don't know how to email that to me. On a side note, recent polls have shown Americans have absolutely no idea about how much wealth is passed and possessed by which parts of the country. I don't have numbers or poll info, but the thing to take away is Americans not only do not have any clue about income inequality exists in America, but they would much prefer a level of distribution similar to Europe, which has been vilified quite brilliantly. Should we note that we are far closer to Namibia at 0.70 than Sweden at 0.23? I assume that's the Gini coefficient. Svengali says, never mind, I'll start it. I just started a goddamn block. Yeah, or send me a picture. I mean, I don't have video today, so I can't. I'm drawing graphs and then I'm showing them to Dorsey's back. That's all I'm doing. Macintologist. Sam, my question for Hacker is whether he thinks a modern precedent for the sharp decay of society, like what's next? How in a handbasket is business as usual? It seems to me the status quo is worse than unsustainable. It's deliberate mass suicide of a nation. Well, I mean, I don't think there's anybody nefariously trying to bring down America. I think it's just really a series of people who are working based on their own personal incentives. And there is a... I don't really know how to describe it other than, and this is, you know, I'm not anti-business. I own a business. It's this show. Truly, this is a business. We almost run it like a business. And soon I hope to be a job creator. Instead of handing out learning annex credits. I'm not anti-business, but there is a business ethos. This notion, a money as an ascendant value ethos. And I love money. But there's an ethos that has taken hold of this country, maybe as a backlash to the 60s, maybe because people were disillusioned by what happened in the late 60s. I don't know. Maybe it's just a natural trajectory of things where... It doesn't matter what you do to society as long as you're maximizing your own gain. It's not even that people are confronted with what they do to society. It's just they're able to ignore it. You know, whether it's those Enron guys or like, you know, more granny's going to be... You remember that? Those IMs, I think, or conversations where he's like, poor granny is going to freeze. When they're fucking with the energy,
California,
the energy market in California by shutting down plants, you know, and creating more demand or choking, throttling supply. And I don't think it's mass suicide. I think it's actually just sort of a loss of a sense that we're part of a society. And, you know, I think there are a lot of things that have fed into it. I think it is sort of a self-reinforcing loop. And, you know, as soon as you start getting like people like Limbaugh in the game, start telling people like, you know, the idea that you have to actually, you know, how do you piss on like on just the very notion of people driving a hybrid? Like, you know, like at what cost is there possibly to you, the only thing that you're doing is you're trying to essentially isolate people from their relationship to society and to the world around them in some fashion. That's it. I understand why he does it. He wants to allow people a vacation from any sense of that obligation because it is an obligation and it is somewhat of a burden. And, you know, if you can be the person who somehow relieves people of that burden, of that notion that you actually need to, of that notion that you need to in some way give back to society, then people are going to keep listening to you because you make them feel good about their lesser selves. And that's a good technique. At least for a, you know, radio show, I guess. I got to get into that a little bit. Let's see. G-Beard, already signed up. Are we supposed to get an email confirming our sponsorship status or something? Yes, that will be coming very shortly. Really happy to see the show back on the road again. Well done. Thank you. Kudos, of course, to Dorsey and to Evan and to Kyle, who have made this completely possible. Todd Slater, thanks for another show. You're welcome. Spayf, I saw a biting editorial cartoon yesterday. Obama was on his belly wearing a pilgrim hat. A turkey was standing on top of him, pecking at him. Two men were standing off to the side. Caption read, I wish you would fight back once in a while. I laughed till I cried, not in a good way. Bad teeth, no running car. I guess we're still not winners. I use we in empathy. Thank you, Spayf. I appreciate that. Superfunk, do you think there will be a backlash when health care reform bill kicks in and people are forced to buy insurance? No. Personally, have I had to cancel my insurance? No, I think actually people are going to appreciate the fact that, well, look, there may be a small backlash, but I don't think it'll be very big. I mean, who knows by 2014 what the deal is, but, you know, the tough aspect about health care reform in general is that 20% use 80% of healthcare services. And so for most of us, we're paying for health insurance that we will not use. It's just that when you need to use it, when you need it, you really need it. And more often than not, it's not there. So, but I don't think there'll be a backlash. Superfunk, a lot of people might not realize they're going to have to do this. Well, it's not terribly different than Social Security. The way that it's actually going to function is my sense. And I've always felt that there's no reason to call it a mandate. Simply call it, you know, Social Security is a mandate. We are forced to buy retirement insurance via Social Security taxes. You will be forced to buy health insurance via a tax that will be levied upon you if you do not have it. If you have it, then you will be exempt from that tax. That's the way it will happen. Pluger, tech feedback on your contact email may be wrong in PayPal. It says, majority.reporters at Gmail. It says, majority.reporters in Gmail?
Where's that at?
In PayPal. But majority.reporters should go to, yes, majority.reporters at Gmail. Will you test that out? It should go to that.
Sure, I'll test it. I know in Gmail, you having can put a dot and not having a dot are kind of the
right.
same thing.
But the reason why I do that, and the reason why I did that, Dorsey, is because we can put a filter on there for majority dot reporters, which will allow us to hear about any PayPal issues. Separate those out. Because one thing that I am determined to do is to provide good service to our members in a way that was never done at Air America. My whole life is now just focused upon making the people who set up Air America feel bad about themselves, and they don't care about what I do. Gravitune. I work on Macs for a living and program as well. I offer my services. So what we'd like to hear, Gravitune, please send an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. majorityreporters@gmail.com. After Evan gets out of the hospital today, he will contact you because Evan's going home right after the podcast goes up. So we'll be back on this tomorrow, but maybe you can help him out, figure out what is wrong with we can't get our computer and the laptop too.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Gravitune 2001. Just put in the subject line Gravitune 2001, and Evan will be in touch. Wingbeth, happy Monday. Are you sure you don't want to just dedicate the next two full days of Majority Report show, post-show, pre-Thanksgiving family banter prep? Please help us. Well, like I say, I'm going to do that on Wednesday. The show on Wednesday is going to be Taibbi and We're going to set up. We'll take your emails before then, and we'll set up. Like, maybe we'll do the IM during there, and maybe we'll try and do the phone calls. Maybe we'll try that.
We'll try.
Donald Rummy. Chalmers Johnson was a crazy man. What empire? This has always been a country of peace. So what if I personally did business with Saddam Hussein? The only empire is the New York Yankees. We're going to have to put up that Chalmers Johnson maybe tomorrow.
Okay.
I have the audio. Or you can show me actually how to post the podcast. Maybe I can put up an extra podcast that...
Yeah, I can show you how to do that.
That we could just put on the page. It doesn't go into the feed.
We'll talk to Kyle about getting off the feed, yeah.
Does promoting the show require us to learn how to perform the aggressive pat-down from the TSA? Sam, don't draw in the air when you're on the radio, says Hi Pop. Good point. Sarek, I have a G5, and it works fine. You can run Leopard on it, and there's nothing that an Intel processor can do that the G5 can't, except talking on GTalk. Well, that's pretty big for us. I can fix your computer for you, but where are you located? In NYC? Recycle the modem. We did that!
Yeah, it's a specific problem to the G5. The rest of the network's working fine, but the G5 runs all the cameras and everything.
Is anyone paying attention to my IMs? Yes, Sarek. Credit the cartoon. It was by the great Mike Lukovich. Sarek, why don't you email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Evan will get in touch with you. We will start a battle royale between you and Gravitoon. Who is the better IT guy for Max? Benevolent Spung, great to have you back on air, Sammy. Do you believe that still have that 360 clip of you saying, what are you talking about, my all-time favorite?
Woof, woof.
What are you talking about?
Wow. I haven't heard that in a long time. She's significantly older.
What are you talking about? What are you talking about?
Oh, my gosh. God, I remember when she was cute. Drad Manthes, sorry if I missed, but have you mentioned the Pope's new stand on contraception on the show? Yes, I did. Sounds like a pretty big change for the Catholic Church. It's not contraception, because it's only for male prostitutes having sex with male Johns. Wait, why did he have to say male prostitutes? That was the part I didn't deal with. Why couldn't it have just been guy on guy activity?
Doing his part to encourage business.
I really do think there's something deeper there. Gay sex only happens if you pay. I mean, from what I've heard. From what I've read. We may have to shoot that, Doris. You may have to reshoot the YouTube for that. Because that really is the point, isn't it?
It is.
Gay sex is only something that happens between a male prostitute and someone who might not want other people to know he's having sex with men for no particular reason. Maybe he's like a farmer, and farmers aren't allowed to get married and be with men or women. Or maybe he's a doctor, and doctors are not allowed to have sex with anyone. Oh, God. Do you imagine, like, we got to shoot that YouTube. Remember, hey, wasn't your guest Tina Dubey's idea for TV what Air America was for radio? Exactly. I think I said that to her. Is it antithetical to progressive values to have entertaining opinion on media and network? No. Nor is it one. No. I said that to her. And I think I said it on air. But that's what Al Franken's show essentially was. Because he had it on Sundance. So, yeah, I think we've had that. It's just that, you know, particularly when Democrats are in power, then the, like, sort of the establishment, you know, Democrats come out and they poo-poo anything that is, you know, it's highly illiberal. to have to talk of politics in such way. Or to win elections. Fight for the middle class. Robert Rubin's head. I have a great idea is to increase income inequality. I mean to decrease income inequality. Rush Limpdick. These are all the same people. Hybrids are for sissies. Please remember to vote for Bristol on Dancing with the Stars tonight. She's the best dancer in the world, unlike that liberal elitist Jennifer Gray. I'm happy now. David Sirota just had a baby boy, Isaac Irving. Good luck to Sirota. That dude ain't never going to get another wink of sleep, right?
Outside of our experience.
Not all of ours, Chief. Don't be a putz. One way the MS mainstream media insulates itself against the perspectives of the super non-rich, non-super rich, is by making everyone with an MSM platform extremely wealthy, him or herself. Making someone wealthy is the best way to change someone's politics. I don't know if that's necessarily true, but possibly. I got news for you. If someone made me very, very wealthy right now, well, I probably would never get invited back onto TV, because the first time I went back there, I would be like, I indict all of us for being here. If I could just spend money on just advertising, I didn't have to go on television. I'd buy ads on TV. That'd be funny. Buy ads during those shows for an internet show. Be like in 2000 when they were to advertise websites. Would the Pope be against postmenopausal sex by a married couple because it has no chance of procreating? Good question. Don't be a putz. That may make it into my YouTube today. That's another good question. If it's just about procreation, postmenopausal sex. I should put postmenopausal sex for money.
then it's okay.
Harold, I wonder what the TSA's response would be to passengers traveling in Speedos to avoid both x-rays and groping. Right, I wonder, is there a prohibition about being shirtless in an airport?
I know a couple ways to find out.
I bet you we're going to find out very soon.
Yeah. This step out of line day, what is it, don't grope me day is happening? What day is it? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I haven't heard of this.
There's a movement online to basically say, I'm not going to do the x-ray thing, you got to feel me up. And if enough people do that, it's going to bring the travel to a standstill.
Yeah.
A standstill. Yeah. And, you know, good. This is just theater anyways. We need one of those machines out in front of this, of our offices. Turkas, want to make people feel better when they are poor and starving? Tell them that that God loves them. And they'll get their reward in heaven. Yes, well, I mean, that's been, that's long-term plan, right? Where's Marc Maron? He was captured by the Bilder Group or Obama's thugs? Did the musings get to him? What the fuck? Well, WTF, that's it. I mean, oh, this is Jim and Alex Jones. Maron had a little run-in with Alex Jones at one point. You know, Alex Jones was bragging about Drudge seems to be sort of like headed down that road, right?
Oh, yeah.
If you could invest in Alex Jones right now, I would. We're headed towards Crazyville, folks. You know what we need to do is start the show with a theremin.
Can we keep the Benjamin Liners over it?
The majority. Bruce Childress. Hi, Sam. Good show. I like the punk patriot. Please let me have for once turn the great Sammy onto something you didn't know about. Found him through Crooks and Liars, the punk patriot. Haven't seen it. I'll check it out. Crane, shame that Chalmers Johnson has passed away. Yes, we have a new real need for high-profile advocates, decreases in military spending, and a closing of Cold War-era bases around the world. Yes, you're right, Cranes. Kubi's bong. Let's light one up in memory of Chalmers Johnson. Shank, oh, yes. Listen, I had this down. The Zune thing. We're working on it. But Zune will take the RSS feed, is my understanding. But you should also know that despite the fact of the burgeoning Zune marketplace, I am told by our web guru that Zune makes up 0.4%. 0.4%. Not even half a percent of our download traffic right now. Now, granted, that number is in the thousands. But 0.4%, that's almost a smaller figure than the amount of Americans who control like 40% of our wealth.
It might be the same guys, though. We might be missing out on that.
That's right. That's true. That's a good point. They could be extremely well. That's where all our Majority Report members are probably hiding out. The Zune crowd. Okajik, for Pubs win presidency in 2012, don't you think they'll repeal the health insurance mandate? It may not even make it to 2015. Well, it's 2014 that it comes in, but you're right. Thanks for doing the show in spite of your collective mishaps. Seem to have the right attitude. Remember, don't let it beat you. Well, I mean, you know, kudos to Evan for showing up today. It was very... extremely helpful that you showed up.
Somebody's got to run.
That's the point. He's like, I'll be yelling into a box right now. Where can we find illegal archives like that site used to post Randy's show? What do you want? What do you mean? Illegal archives of what? Of this show? You don't need illegal. You go to iTunes. You can find illegal archives of what show? That was the White Rose Society. I don't, you know, people have tightened up on that stuff because now they're all invested. Like when they used to play Randy's shows or Hartman shows, it was because Air America were too stupid to say, hey, stop doing that. That's how we're supposed to make our money. Morons.
Maybe he means old Majority Report shows that are illegal.
That's a good question. I will start to trickle those out, but I don't know if. I think the guy who bought the Air America servers wiped it all clean. I mean, they're out there somewhere, but... Evan by Hoover, you need to follow my friend Huge Jadet. He's away. Mark Maron is God. Please keep up the good work, Sammy. Please download WTF with Mark Maron. Like Maron needs to advertise on this show. Dane Cook the Man. Is it true that Maron applied to work with the TSA? Klug, love the website. The website rocks. Thank you. Kyle, awesome. We're even going to do a redesign soon. It's going to be even better. The reason why two men would do it would be for money. Couldn't possibly be love, says Macintologist. Of course. Todd Slater, what you just said about Limbaugh's technique in a sense is what you do as well. Speaking for myself at least, one of my favorite things about your show is in its various incarnations, the fact you remind me I'm not nuts for thinking what I think. Well, I mean, I think audiences are self-selective. That's right. But and you may think that there are times where it's appropriate to doubt yourself. But I express doubt on this show. I say things like, I don't know. Or like, I feel bad because I'm not taking somebody else's position. It's different. It's not a question of edifying your belief system. It's a question of saying that doubt itself is not necessary. Limbaugh's message is not about a specific belief system. It is about the notion of doubt itself. Do not have any doubt on anything. About anything. Never doubt yourself. And I don't espouse that. I try and provide information. There are plenty of times where I have said, I'm wrong, I stand corrected. Where a listener tells me something, you know, that does not happen on Limbaugh's show. He does not revisit things. It's not that Limbaugh is telling people you're not nuts for thinking the way you are. what Limbaugh is telling people is that that creeping doubt in your mind that you should help that other person or that you're somehow doing something wrong, squash it. Squash it. Squash it. It's not necessary. It's evil. It's wrong. Spay F, did you see Bill Gates' latest attack on teachers? He wants to go after their master's bonus. Oh, you know what? I'll talk about this tomorrow because we've got to wrap the things up. I saw the lottery, and I'll talk about it tomorrow, but huge piece of steaming propaganda. And I read a good review by Ravitch, Diane Ravitch. Sounds like Waiting for Superman was the exact same movie. I mean, almost down to the entire cast. And same steaming piece of garbage. I mean, good film, good piece of propaganda. Had an argument with Nikki about it. But, you know, I got to also talk to Rosen because, you know, those type of movies, they get me so angry. I think I felt this way after I saw True Lies, too, that the first time, the Schwarzenegger movie. I remember how angry I was that I spent $9 on that. But that's neither here nor there. All right, folks, can't take any more of your IMs because I got to go. I've been informed that nevertheless, despite our skepticism about the Zune, it will show up in the Zune marketplace soon. It's been submitted, et cetera, et cetera. Talk to you tomorrow. To get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught, but seeing the truth is